In a few seconds I felt almost normal again. I don't feel very weightless now, I thought, and pushed down sharply with my hands on either side of the seat. I rose in a slow and, more or less, graceful sweep, almost to the ceiling of the compartment. My rise would have been more graceful except that I had apparently applied the force somewhat to the rear of my center of mass, so that my body tipped forward as I rose, and also rotated to my left. By the time I had started to fall back, I was almost head downward, and I was forced to reach out and grasp the back of the seat to right myself. The result was that I came to rest with my knees in the chair, and my eyes only a few inches from the back cushion. It was then that I saw something which I had overlooked when I had first entered the ship. It was only a simple design imprinted in the material of the seat, but I recognized the symbol, and the recognition must have produced a strong mental shockwave which Alan mistook for fear or pain, because the gravity was immediately normalized, causing me to experience another rough moment as my organs all attempted to occupy the space normally assigned to my intestines. "What is it?" I heard Alan say, and for the first time there seemed to be a definite trace of concern. "Then oh, I see you have noticed the symbol and recognize its significance." "Yes," I said. "Anyone who has ever read to any extent would recognize the symbol of the tree and the serpent. It is found, in one form or another, in the legends, the inscriptions and the carvings of virtually every one of our early races. It has always seemed to me to be a peculiarly earthly symbol, and it was startling to see it appear from the depths of space, or from whatever planet you call home." "These are questions which I had hoped to put off until there is more time," Alan replied. "It is difficult even to outline, in a few minutes of discussion, the events of many centuries. For it has been centuries since we have called any planet home. The spaceships upon which we live, and work and learn, have been our only home for generations. Most of them are quite large as compared with your ocean-going vessels, and we have long since developed technological abilities that make us independent of any planet. Our ships are closed systems. That is, all matter within the craft remains there, nothing is emitted, ejected or lost from it. We have learned simple methods of reducing all compounds to their elements, and for recombining them in any form required for our use. For example, we breathe in the same manner as you. That is, our lungs take in oxygen from the air, and some of that oxygen is converted to carbon dioxide in the body processes. Therefore, the air in our ship is constantly passed through solutions which contain plant-like organisms which absorb the carbon dioxide, use the carbon in their own growth, and return the oxygen to the air. Eventually those plants become one of our foods. The dozens of natural cycles through which life is created and are maintained on a planet such as yours, are all duplicated within our ship. Since the size of our ships is small compared to a planet, the cycles must move more rapidly, and under precisely controlled conditions, but in every other respect, the cycles of life and reproduction are the same. There is, of course, some loss of energy occurring during these cycles, which must be replaced from some outside source. As I mentioned a few moments ago, when we are in the vicinity of a star such as your sun, we can easily collect all the energy we require, just as your planet receives more energy from your sun than you are using. During our occasional interstellar journeys, our ship may be traveling for one or more generations in areas which are rather remote from any star, and, although we can still collect some energy, we must depend primarily upon that stored in our energy banks. It may be difficult for you to conceive of a race of intelligent beings who spend all of our lives within the relatively restricted confines of a spaceship. You may even be inclined to feel pity for such a race. We, on the other hand, are inclined to feel pity for the relatively primitive races which are still confined to the surface of a single planet, where they are unable to control many of the conditions around them, and often become the helpless victims of earthquakes, floods, tornadoes, tidal waves, blizzards, drought, and a dozen other hazards which constantly threaten those who dwell upon the surface of a planet. Every aspect of our environment is precisely controlled within our ships. The temperature is maintained within a fraction of a degree, the humidity, the atmospheric pressure, and even the gravitational force which we create within our ships, are all maintained at the exact point of maximum desirability. While our bodies seldom leave the ship, our technology has provided us with almost unlimited extensions of our senses so that, for the purpose of observation, learning and understanding, we can be intimately present at any time and at any place which we may choose to observe or to visit, providing that the place is within a few thousand miles of our ship. Through a portion of our technology which your race has not yet begun to acquire, we are able to generate and apply simple forces at points quite remote from our craft. Our abilities may be somewhat startling and incredible to some of your people, but they are not actually as startling and incredible as the scientific knowledge and abilities your people now have, compared to those which your own ancestors possessed a few hundred years ago. Any scientific knowledge or ability seems incredible to those who have not yet achieved it. You are perfectly correct when you point out that the symbol of the tree and the serpent is a common one in the history and legends of your people. It is also fairly common among several of the races in space. The symbol is a natural one which seems to spring spontaneously to the mind, perhaps because life is said to originate in the waters of a planet, and the undulations of a serpent are a convenient symbol for the waves of a sea. The tree is almost always the symbol of life, beginning in the sea, rising to the atmosphere, and finally into space. There is another factor which may, perhaps, have some significance. Your people and some of mine, including myself, have, at least in part, a common ancestry. Next headline, Atlantis and Lemuria. Tens of thousands of years ago, some of our ancestors lived upon this planet, Earth. There was, at that time, a small continent in a part of the now sea-covered area which you have named the Pacific Ocean. Some of your ancient legends refer to this sunken landmass as the lost continent of Lemuria, or Mu. Our ancestors had built a great empire and a mighty science upon this continent. At the same time, there was another rapidly developing race upon a landmass in the southwestern portion of the present Atlantic Ocean. In your legends, this continent has been named Atlantis. There was rivalry between the two cultures, in their material and technological progress. It was friendly at first, but became bitter with the passing years, as each race flaunted its achievements in the face of the other. In a few centuries their science had passed the point which your race has reached. Not content with releasing a few crumbs of the binding energy of the atom, as your science is now doing, they had learned to rotate entire masses upon the energy axis. Energies equal to 75 million of your kilowatt-hours were released by the conversion of a bit of matter about the mass of one of your copper pennies. With the constantly increasing bitterness between the two races, and with their constantly increasing command of destructive energies, it was inevitable that they should eventually destroy each other. The energies released in that destruction were beyond all human imagination. They were sufficient to cause major shifts in the surface configuration of the planet, and the resulting nuclear radiation was so intense and so widespread, that the entire surface became virtually unfit for habitation, for a number of generations. The balance of this discussion must wait, however, until our return. Our time is more than up. Already it is requiring too much energy to keep our ship in its present position, and we cannot abandon the cargo craft. It is on the ground now, and I will open the door. We will wait until you are a little distance from the craft before we retrieve it. As you would say, so long and take care of yourself until we return. Like a person walking in his sleep, I stepped down from the floor of the craft, and stumbled a dozen paces through the sand before I turned to look back. The door had closed behind me and, as I turned, a horizontal band of orange-colored light appeared about the central, or widest part of the ship, and it leapt upward as though it had been released from a catapult. The air rushing in to replace that which had been displaced upward, impelled me a full step forward and almost caused me to lose my balance. I managed to keep my eyes on the craft while the band of light went through the colors of the spectrum from orange to violet. As the light went through the violet band, the craft had risen several thousands of feet in the air, and I could follow it no longer. A strong sense of depression settled over me then. I felt as though my work, and consequently my life had lost all significance. A few hours before, I had been a rather self-satisfied engineer, setting up instruments for the testing of one of the largest rocket motors in existence. While I realized that my part in the project was a small one, I felt that, through my work, I was traveling in the forefront of progress. Now I knew that rocket motors, however efficient they might be, had been obsolete for thousands of years. I felt like a small and insignificant cog in a clumsy and backward science, which was moving only toward its own destruction. For a long time I stood in the sand, looking from the crumpled patch of brush, up to the stars. Alan had said that their ship would return in a few months, and he would contact me again. Did he mean it, or was it just a polite parting gesture? He had not asked me for a final decision in regard to the assistance they would require. Perhaps he was satisfied that I would offer it, and perhaps he had decided that I was incompetent to give it. I had no way of knowing and could only wait. The most difficult part of waiting was that I was not sure exactly what I was waiting for. I could not report, or even mention to anyone, what had happened on the evening of July 4th, first, because I had tacitly agreed that I would not, and secondly, because I was sure that no one would believe me if I did. I went on with my work of testing various types and sizes of rocket motors, but most of my previous enthusiasm was gone. Having learned how space travel should be approached, it was very difficult for me to trudge along, following a clumsy and obsolete branch of technology which I knew had been abandoned by other races, thousands of years before. Days passed and grew into weeks. Weeks passed and became months, with no further word from Alan or his companions. There were many UFO sightings over and around the area of the Proving Ground. Each time one was reported, I would think, perhaps this is it. Perhaps they are back and will now tell me what I am expected to do, and when. I knew that the how was something I would have to work out for myself. Still nothing happened. Each new sighting over the Proving Ground brought excitement and conviction to those who observed the object, and elicited banal and highly improbable earthly explanations from those who had not. In the meantime, I had completed the first test series, had returned to my home in California, and finally had been sent back to White Sands with a second series of tests to perform. I had given up the thought that I would hear any more of Alan, his people, or his plan to take up residence on Earth. It had seemed so incredible to begin with, and the passage of time had made it even more so. I had almost decided that I had been the victim of some form of temporary insanity, and had often congratulated myself on my caution which had prevented me from reporting the event to any of my superiors or to my fellow workers. On a Tuesday evening, just after I had left the officers' mess, where I usually took my meals, and as I was heading across the roadway and parking lot to the H building, where I was quartered, I suddenly remembered that I had neglected to switch off the power to the main instrument panel, after the test run we had made that afternoon. It was not a very serious oversight. Several amplifiers would be on all night and a tube or two might burn out if they overheated. Even this was quite unlikely, but leaving the instrument panel on was contrary to a rule which I, myself, had laid down with some firmness, and I could not understand how I could have been so thoughtless. It would have been a long walk to the test stand, but fortunately, there was no need to walk. The company car was parked next to the H building, and the key was in the ignition. 5 minutes later, I had reached the test bay, had parked the car and was striding toward the instrument room. The days were shorter now, and it was already dusk. Before I had reached the instrument room, my attention was drawn to a dim glow that seemed to hover just above the top of the test stand. I knew of no light that had been mounted in this position, and this glow seemed to be a foot or more in diameter, and too dim to be any kind of light fixture. As I walked quickly toward it, a sudden suspicion entered my mind, and was confirmed almost immediately when Alan's voice came to me as though he was standing at my side. "Yes, Dan, it's ours. Since we are not using the sampling craft now, we thought it best to send down a small communications amplifier. We could get along without it, but it does have advantages, and it reduces the chance of error in our communications almost to zero. Incidentally, You can quit worrying about your instrument panel. You did turn it off this afternoon, but we had to persuade you to come out here for a talk without mentioning it to anyone else. It was some time before I could make any reply. My mind was whirling. So it was true after all. Or was it a hallucination, and was this another attack coming on? Finally, I gave up the pointless conjecture and said to myself, it seems to be real, and I'll just have to handle it as though it were. An excellent decision. Alan said, as though he had been listening to my thoughts. I can assure you that it is real. Far more so than many of the things your people accept as reality. However, we didn't get you out here just to talk about sanity or hallucination. We must discuss the future. Although it may take more time than we at first estimated, it now seems certain that I will be able to adapt my body to your environment closely enough so that I will be able to pass for a native of your planet. To do that successfully will, of course, require a number of things which only one who is already an accepted resident of Earth can obtain for me. The time has come when you must make the final decision as to whether you will be that person. It is a free choice on your part, and there is no penalty for refusal. If you do not wish to assist us, you will be permitted to return to your quarters at once. All memory of this meeting and the previous one will be erased from your mind, but everything else will be the same. You will be no worse off than before we came. If, on the other hand, you do decide to assist us, you may find yourself in a situation that is not easy to endure. You will have thankless tasks and seemingly profitless investments of time, effort and money. Your reputation will probably suffer, at least in the beginning, and you may find yourself much worse off than before. The only reward we can promise you is the inward satisfaction of having assisted in the survival of your race, and the acquisition of considerable knowledge and understanding that you would not otherwise be able to gain. That last sentence of yours did the trick, I said. Up to that point, you hadn't sounded like much of a salesman. In fact, you seemed determined to dissuade me from taking the job, but it has always seemed to me that the acquisition of knowledge, experience and understanding, together with service to one's fellow men, were the only valid excuses for living. If you can assure me that you are acting only for the welfare of my people, I will be yours to command. Thank you, was the reply. I wasn't trying to discourage you, but we did not want you to have any illusions about earthly rewards. We neither ask nor receive any reward for what we do, and, in the end you will learn, as we did, that the greatest and the most enduring reward is the knowledge of having served. We cannot truthfully say that we are acting for the welfare of your people. In the beginning at least, we will be working only for their survival. If they survive, then we can work for their welfare. If they do not survive, welfare has no meaning. That is good enough for me, I said. Just let me know what you want done, and if there is any possibility at all, I will do it. You won't be asked to do anything beyond your ability, Alan said. Although sometimes it may seem so, our analysts have determined your abilities quite precisely, and in several areas, they are considerably greater than you think. However, there should be no great difficulty with the things we require now. First of all, while I have a fairly good command of your spoken language, my knowledge of your written language is only rudimentary, and must be perfected before I can mingle with your people. I would appreciate, therefore, copies of any of your textbooks designed to overcome illiteracy, both in reading and writing your language. I could also use any of your textbooks on higher or lower mathematics, since our system of mathematical computation varies in several significant respects from yours. Our ancestors, like yours, had 10 fingers upon which they first learned to count. The inevitable result was that we developed an entire computation system very similar to that which you have now, based upon multiples of 10. From long habit, this system continued in use several generations after it had been fully realized that a system based upon multiples of 12 would be far simpler and more useful, primarily because of its greater divisibility. As you know, 12 is divisible by 2, 3, 4 and 6, whereas 10 is divisible only by 2 and 5. Finally, our race decided to break the habit of the past, at any cost, and established by law a mathematical system based upon multiples of 12. For several generations there was a mild form of mathematical chaos which resulted from the refusal or the inability of some to give up the old way of counting, even though they recognize the ultimate benefits to be gained by accepting the new. Eventually it became necessary to destroy all mathematical texts based upon multiples of 10, and forbid any further publication of them. The law was unusual, and considered harsh by many, but it did succeed in converting our race to the 12-based system. Consequently, while I am considered to be a very competent mathematician among our people, I would have difficulty in passing a simple arithmetic test in one of your elementary schools. As you can see, my problems are not simply the adaptation of my body to your environment. I must also adapt my mind to your habits of thought if I am to be successful in posing as one of you. We could acquire most of the material we need directly from the minds of your people, and some of this has been done by investigating groups in the past, but, because it is done without the knowledge or consent of the subject, such mind probing is contrary to our rules concerning the right of privacy, and is permitted only in cases of emergency. I am afraid we have already stretched these rules severely in your case, but there seemed to be no alternative. As far as my mind is concerned, I said, you are welcome to dredge around in it as much as you please, but I had better get you the textbooks anyway. I'm afraid my mind doesn't contain very many, and there are probably lots of typographical errors. How will I deliver the books to you, or how will you pick them up? Also, how long will you need them? We have a library, of sorts, in a large Quonset hut, here at the base. I could get quite a lot of material there, but I would be in trouble if I did not bring it back. One day will be ample for us to analyze and to copy it, Alan replied. If we pick them up one evening, we can return them the next. On your test stand, directly below our communications device, there is a metal ledge with a protective roof above it. Tomorrow night, when you leave the area, place as many books as you can obtain by then, on the ledge. We will drop a small sampling device to pick them up, and they will be returned to the same place the following night. Alan's earthly education went on in this manner for almost 2 months. He must have been a very fast student, because the amount of material, books and general data that I sent him, should have been sufficient to keep an average student occupied for several years. Just a few days before I was scheduled to return home to California, I picked up the last batch of books I had sent, and found between two of them, neatly written on paper which I had furnished him, and with a pen which I had also furnished him, a brief note from Alan, which read, Dan, I think I am getting the hang of it now. Thanks again for all the books, but don't send any more because we won't be able to pick them up. We have another small job to do and will be away for a while. Yours, Alan. There was something strangely appealing about the note. It seemed to me almost like a graduation card from a student whom I had taught but had never seen. I kept the note among my papers for almost a year. As the weeks and months went by, and finally became years, without any further contact, I again began to feel that I had heard the last of Alan and his plan to take up residence on Earth. This time I had no suspicion of hallucination, or doubt about my sanity. The contact had been too long and too detailed, and too much information had passed between us. The knowledge and information I had received from Alan had proven to be valid, and some of it had been exceedingly useful to me in my work. There was no possibility that it could all have originated in my own mind. Alan was real enough, and so were his companions and their ship. But something must have caused them to change their plans, or surely I would have heard something more, especially since it had been implied that I was to play a part in those plans. During the last week in April of 1954, I had taken a brief vacation from the endless problems of rocket development, and had driven to my special retreat, deep in the woods of southern Oregon. There were several difficult decisions I would soon have to make, and I needed a place of complete peace and isolation in which to make them. For some time I had felt a growing responsibility to make a complete report of the arrival of extraterrestrial beings, and the landing of the sampling device, at the White Sands Proving Ground. If Alan had given up his plan to visit the Earth, such a report could not harm him or his people, and might be of some benefit to ours. In our brief conversations, Alan had described several of the problems now facing our society, and threatening our civilization, and even our survival as a race, problems which were not yet completely understood by our people, but which would become critical within a relatively short time. He had also outlined some of the means by which the impact of these problems could be eased and their pressure lessened when, finally, we could no longer ignore them. The question which had continued to grow in my mind, now demanded an answer. If Alan had changed his mind about using his knowledge and experience for the benefit of our race, was it not my responsibility to use, as best I could, the knowledge and understanding he had imparted to me? I realized, of course, that very few people were likely to consider seriously anything I might say, but it was the mere fact that I probably could not succeed, a valid excuse for not trying. It seemed that the only certain solution would be to discuss the problem with Alan himself. While I had no means of establishing contact with Alan, I was sure that if he, and his ship, were anywhere in the vicinity of the Earth, he could, if he chose, make contact with me. He had given me a rather detailed explanation of the electronic beam modulation of the auditory nerve, which makes communication possible between individuals over very considerable distances, and one of the thoughts in the back of my mind when I had started for my retreat, was that it would be an ideal spot for such a communication, if Alan were still around, and still had any interest in me. I had been completely alone for 3 days, without having reached any decisions on my problems, and had almost given up hope of contact with Alan, when, early in the evening of the third day, his voice came to me in its usual abrupt fashion. "Well, Dan, how much longer are you going to hide your light under a bushel?" In spite of the fact that I had come 800 miles, and had been waiting for 3 days in the hope of making this contact, I was just as startled as though I had never heard Alan's voice before. I looked around quickly, half expecting to see someone standing in the shadows, although I knew there could be no one there. Finally, I recovered enough to make an answer, though all I could say was, "What do you mean?" "You know what I mean," Alan replied. "In your greatest book of wisdom and philosophy, which you call the Holy Bible, a copy of which you were kind enough to send me along with the other books, it is stated, when a man has lighted a candle, he does not place it under a bushel, but holds it forth so that men may be guided by its light. We have expended considerable time and patience in the effort to light a few candles among the many nations of your planet. It has been our hope that the light of these candles might grow in brilliance until they expose the terrible abyss toward which the people of your world are so blindly rushing. We have given you information which is both of interest and of value to your people. Why do you keep it to yourself?" "In the first place," I said, "I was afraid that any report by me might endanger your proposed visit on Earth, if you still plan to make it. In the second place, I am unknown. Except for a few people in the rocket business, no one has ever heard of me. How could I reach the people, and who would listen if I could? Those who are not blind to truth can recognize the value of a message regardless of the status of the messenger," Alan replied. "Our estimate of 4 years for adaptation to your environment was over-optimistic. The actual time will be closer to 5. In the meantime, one of your major problems is becoming critical. Unless some small balancing force is applied in the right quarters, your entire civilization may wipe itself out in a planet-wide holocaust before we are in a position to be of assistance. You are one of the very few who are now in a position to create that small but critical balancing force. Write what you have learned from us in a book. If you take a few precautions which we will explain to you, the report will not endanger my stay on your planet. Repeat what we have told you through your newspapers, your radio and television stations, and if necessary, shout it from the housetops, but let the people know the critical nature of their position." "You don't realize what you are asking," I said. "If I do as you say, a few people may listen, but the great majority will not. There are too many in this world who are afraid of the truth, and even more afraid of anything which might change their way of life, or the existing order of things. If I attempt to make public the information you have given me, it will only mean that I will be scorned and ridiculed. I will be called a liar by some, a fool by others, and a charlatan by still others. If I give a statement to our newspapers, they will either ignore it entirely, or they will print a comic distorted version which will make me appear stupid and ridiculous. It is easier to ridicule than to investigate.